Hi, I'm Greg Schaefer, and welcome to the virtual CISO moment. Chris Kimplin joins us today. He is Senior Information Security and Computer Forensics Engineer for Secure Network Technologies. Chris, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Greg. I appreciate it.
Looking forward to hearing about your journey. We talked right before we started recording that you were actually in the military. You were in the Air Force, or rather you were in the Army. I was in the Air Force. I was going to wear my Air Force hat, but I didn't want to upset you, but I think I might have just done that anyway by saying you were in the Air Force.
So tell us
about your journey.
Yeah. So a lot of people, you know, I've been in the tech space now for 20 plus years. And they're like, oh, did you get into it through the military? And I was like, no, I actually just blew stuff up in the military.
Sometimes we blow stuff up in cyber. So
yeah, I guess whether it's networks or explosives, that's, you know, two different things. But no, I was in the military. I did 9 years in there. I did a deployment to Iraq in 2006, 2007. And then when I got back, I was kind of floating between careers. I didn't have a set career path per se. And I went to a company here in upstate New York that does professional services and technical services for some large companies. I was going for a customer service position, and the receptionist put me in the wrong interview room. She put me in an interview room for a help desk position. Now, I liked computers. I knew enough to be dangerous in a home computer setting. They gave me this test, and I was going through it, and I was like, why are they asking me about routers and printers and things like that? Guy comes back in. Apparently, I did well enough on the test. He's like, hey, we want to offer you the job. And it was $1.50 more an hour than the position I was going for. So I said, sure, I'll take it.
That is the best story I think I've ever heard of how someone got into IT and information security. I just sat in the wrong room,
Greg.
I mean, what if it was the other way around? If you went for like an engineer and you ended up sitting in like, you know, where you're going to be a chef or something, you know, it's like, that would have been weird.
I don't know. I probably could make you a great steak or something, but it all worked out. And thankfully I had some great folks that were on my team that, I just soaked up all the knowledge I could from them and started myself study because, you know, these folks actually went to college for that. I just was in the wrong room. And I've always been more of a self-study guy. I was never winning any super academic awards or anything during my school career. But I love to read and I love to learn. So the tech field just really fit me. And then 2008, I got into a company called Cyber Defender, where I was doing virus removal, and that really just lit my passion for cybersecurity and protecting folks and their businesses and things like that. And the rest has kind of been going from there. Did some years doing kind of help desk and really getting that foundation and help desk, doing corporate help desk, and then I went into a consultant role, and that's where my virtual CISO career started. Did virtual CISO for over 30 companies and had a great time working with all kinds of different environments and teams and things. So,
yeah, a lot of times you see on like LinkedIn and other areas, other platforms, that advice as far as getting into cybersecurity, and a lot of people are bemoaning the fact that it's difficult to get in, like entry level. I'm of the opinion that there is no such thing as an entry level cyber position, that you have to start more in information technology. And I love the fact that you started in at the help desk, because I think you probably have a unique perspective about having started at the help desk, how that helped you not only in the IT career, but the cyber career. Is that a fair thing to say? And if so, what from the early help desk days helped you as you migrated towards and into cyber?
Yeah, I definitely would agree that having that help desk foundation, it taught me, you know, not being traditionally educated. It taught me how the systems work, how networking was supposed to happen. And it taught me the parts of how things were supposed to go. Taught me soft skills, you know, trying to relay technical information to maybe non-technical staff. I know warranty support for Lenovo, and it be like that grandma got a new computer for Christmas and she's trying to get to her email. So, you know, just having those conversations helped me then when I got to help desk talking to staff members and things that were not in the technical periphery. And then as I started getting more advanced with my knowledge of systems and networking, my military brain just kind of kicked in. I've always loved strategy. I've always loved protecting things. And I'm like, well, let's see how things get broken now and what happens if we don't do this. So, but you got to have that base knowledge, in my opinion, because if you don't know how it's supposed to work correctly, then you're going to have a tough time having visibility and trying to protect things when they can go wrong.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. It's very difficult to understand how to protect something if you don't understand that something. I mean, and it seems right to make perfect sense to me. I was going to think of an analogy, but I can't think of, for some reason I had brakes in my head, car brakes, but it's like, no, that's probably not going to, that would be a stretch. But you also, you do get a chance though, that as you understand more about what it is you're protecting, you also, I think, get a better idea of what threats mean to any business, really. You hear something about a threat, like if you hear like ransomware, for example, it's like, well, okay, I know that word, but what does it really mean from the IT side? And you can apply that. So for drawing on that and drawing on also your extensive experience, I don't know if I'm the one who did this initially, but I've turned VCISO into a verb. VCISOing is, I believe, an acceptable term. You've done a lot of VCISOing or VCISOing, I guess. I don't know what sounds better. What rolls off the tongue? But anyway, you've done a lot of VCISOing. From your perspective, from that, what are a couple of the threats most significant to small and mid-sized businesses today, from your perspective?
So I think there is that, you know, I think we all are aware that there's usually a lack of resources, technical resources in companies, especially in the SMB space, right? Most of them maybe have one IT guy or gal. Maybe they have a relationship with an MSP, something like that. But I think what small companies and mid-sized companies face is they have this, they just want to keep doing whatever their business is. And obviously that's what we want them to do, but they don't understand that things like your networking configuration, your Active Directory configuration, if you don't have somebody with those skill sets to configure those correctly and make sure things are solid on the back end, then you're bound to get things like ransomware. Even insider threat is becoming a big thing right now. And when those doors and windows are kind of left open, then that's when, unfortunately, you know, you start getting into the ransomware incident response type stuff. So it's a big deal to have a technical partner or a technical person on the team. It's critical.
When you talk about insider threat, are you referring to malicious insider threat or... I didn't want to say incompetent, maybe just unaware insider threat.
Let's call it shadow IT. How about that?
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously I think we're kind of, we're familiar with the malicious insider threat. I think in that space though, you're going to find that more in the enterprise space, because then you're talking corporate espionage, things like that. In the SMB space, the insider threat really is that shadow IT, where you have users. I mean, it's 2024. Most users are pretty computer literate or enough to be dangerous. And so if your compensating controls are not solid, they may find ways to subvert some of your policies, some of your controls, not necessarily to do anything malicious. Maybe it's they think it's just an easier way to do their job. But so you and I know if they can get around it, somebody else can get around it.
Absolutely.
And then you turn in a small problem into a much larger problem. So
it's interesting you said that. I just saw yesterday, I don't remember the exact percentage, but it was somewhere along the lines of 78%, say plus or minus a few percent, because as I get older, my memory fades. But say 78% roughly of people that work in businesses say that they will willingly subvert controls in order, security controls, in order to do their job. That's huge. That's a problem.
It is huge. And I am not surprised by that number, unfortunately. I think that, you know, as economic times change and the economy changes and jobs become more competitive, people are trying to do whatever they can to get ahead, to be more productive, to, you know, we got remote work since the pandemic, which is huge. And I think that has led to some people being like, well, it's for the greater good that I be able to do this and not have to deal with this multi-factor authentication or, you know, having my files not locally on my system, things like that, that we put in place to protect the environment and the data. And then users are just, they're just trying to do their job. So I try to give them the benefit of the doubt that, you know, they're not doing it for malicious intent, but yeah, you got to make sure that back end is tight so that they can still do their job, but we can do it safely.
It seems like, though, that we're going backwards in some ways, because we talk about that we don't feel that information technology, for example, should take on risk. They're not in the role to take on risk or to decide risk, I should say. That's what first, second line difference is. Risk management should handle that. And yet we see IT a lot making decisions about when what servers they should spin up or spin down or any sort of IT related decisions. They're making risk decisions when they shouldn't. But now we're seeing this from what you just said. We're seeing this, that the end user are now taking on the responsibility of making risk. It's almost like micro risk management. I'm going to coin that right term for the first time here.
Yeah,
and that's a huge issue. When you have, we have shadow IT, now we have shadow risk management. What can we do to maybe reel that in a little bit?
So, I mean, education, user education is important. You know, one of the things I've done as a VCSO is try to explain impact rather than just give somebody a, hey, don't do this with no context. If it's a, don't do this because if you do this, A, B, and C can happen. That resonates with some folks. But I think that you have to, if you have the responsibility of risk management for an organization, you have to assume that even if you educate and even if you tell someone, they're likely going to try to subvert it if it's in the interest of their job. So you got to have compensating controls to minimize the impact if they do that. Educate, and you know, that's definitely an important part of it, but have a secondary plan if the education doesn't work.
It sounds like that the philosophy of maybe them having skin in the game, they understand a little bit more, that helps to at least, I mean, you can't change if they're going to make a decision, but if they're aware, but at least if they're not ignorant of it, you've gone part of the way. But to your point, compensating controls, you're saying, are probably a good thing to have in place regardless.
Yeah, I think you have to have compensating controls, because not only does that help with the user base, but, you know, as we know, the cyber landscape is changing daily. So what may have worked today may not work next week. So have a secondary control in place that if one fails or one's subverted, you have another one that can minimize impact. I think kind of belt and suspenders is what they, what my mentor used to call it. So, you know,
I still have a pair of suspenders from the 90s somewhere in my closet, but, I actually preferred wearing a belt with suspenders back then because it just felt better. And I guess I felt more secure. So I didn't realize it at the time that I was using the principle of compensating controls, because what a risk there is to your pants falling down. I mean, you wouldn't want that to happen, right? No. And I want to have backup in case like my belt breaks because I've had too much tacos recently. I mean, that'd be huge.
Yeah.
I love it. It's always good to try to draw analogies, I think, between what we see in cyber and in real world, because it really does help to stick in people's heads. And I've heard the belt and suspender analogy before, but it's probably going to stick a little bit more for me now. There's a lot of those stress with regards to information security and cybersecurity, and not just making sure that you don't lose your pants. Yeah. And I really, really, I don't like the fact that I see a lot of posts of people who are looking for positions right now. There are a few that I've read recently that not only are they looking for positions, but they're dealing with health issues or family issues, and you have all this coming down. But even without all that, cyber in itself can bring a high level of stress just in general as you go through the workday if you don't keep it in check. What's a couple of things that you do to help keep that stress in check so that it doesn't overwhelm you?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I see the similar thing with burnout, and it kind of is a personal thing for me, because I actually struggled with burnout and developed some pretty serious health issues from that. And that was kind of a wake up call to me. So for me, I believe that is, much as we are attached and we're constantly monitoring things, you also need to detach. So for me, I go out in the woods. I love mountain climbing and hiking and things like that. I discipline myself that when I'm out there, I'm not checking my phone or anything. I'm there to just kind of commune with nature, breathe in some good clean air, and enjoy being out in nature. And that's one of the big things for me. Another is I rock climb. I just like that kind of direct connection with nature and the rock, and seeing these just beautiful creations that are out there for us to enjoy.
So just is
de-stress.
Is the rock climbing, this is where you have devices to help you? Or is it just like free rock climbing, or?
I do both. So I do bouldering, which is no devices. If you fall, you're probably only going to fall about 20 feet. And then the other is with ropes and carabiners and all that good stuff. So
that's another great example of risk and compensating controls. Although I find it interesting that sometimes we, and I'm included here too, We deal with the risk and the stress of risk from one industry with risk in another industry or another activity. And I think that that's actually, there's probably some psychological studies on this, that the way people are wired, that if they're constantly in this area, then having another risk that's hopefully a safe risk, but pushing the edge just enough that it gets everything flowing, your adrenaline and all that. But it's a great example of also risk. We'll take the rock climbing, not the boulder climbing, or whatever the correct nomenclature was, the one that you have to have the ropes and the other equipment. The threat, the risk there is, let's see if I get this right. The risk is gravity. The threat is the fact that you will succumb to gravity and therefore will have severe bodily injury and possibly death. And then the primary control. Let's see, the primary control would probably be the rope. The secondary control would be the skill set, would be maybe you have some sort of protective clothing. maybe just in the planning, that would be a secondary control as well too. You can actually like mirror all these things to cybersecurity.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it goes back to, as I'm sure you did in your Air Force days, whenever we were doing an exercise, you have to put a risk plan for it, right? What's the risk? What's the potential impact? How are you going to mitigate it? It's the same thing when I go rock climbing. I may put an extra, you know, hitch in my rope. I may put an extra, secure another location on the rock. So if one falls out, I'm caught by another. So you plan these things to ultimately get to whatever goal it is you want to get to, and do it as safely as possible.
So. And I think that sometimes when people, as they go through their information security career, and in fact, if they lean more towards the GRC area and they start hearing about risk, or maybe they hear about risk and that kind of freaks them out because it's like, I don't understand risk. The truth is, you understand risk a lot more than you think you do, because you deal with it in everything you do every day, even driving and all that. You deal with risk. Yeah. And so I often tell folks that if you can take that mindset and equate it, information security risk is just the same. You're just looking at things to mitigate the fact from it happening. Or sometimes you just want to go ahead and accept it. It's just like, at some point in time, with all the controls you have defeating gravity there, you accept the residual risk, and there you go. Hopefully you climb up and you don't have like a bird poop on you or anything. Ever have bird poop on you?
Not yet.
I've had a couple of Celsiuses today, and it's like, oh, that just popped or pooped into my head. I don't know. So, but I think
it's great that you touched on that last point, and I think it's important, especially for folks that may be younger in their InfoSec world. Is I think we have to be okay that there's going to be acceptable risk, right?
Yes.
We're never ever going to be able to mitigate or, you know, put in compensating controls to completely eliminate risk. It's your ability to assess the risk, the impact, and be like, okay, this is an acceptable risk that I've mitigated it to this point, or no, I need to do more. And I think where a lot of folks struggle is they're like, if I can't completely shore this up and minimize the risk, then I'm doing something wrong, or I need to go buy a new piece of hardware or something like that. So I'm glad you touched on that.
Yeah, it's I appreciate the insight with regards to that as well too. What are your future plans? You planning to scale El Capitan or something like that?
No, my large scale days are behind me.
Come on. Jim Kirk did it when he was like 50.
I know. Well, I also have a wife that, you know, I recently watched a documentary called Free Solo, and this guy free soloed El Cap in Yosemite, which is this huge.
I believe I know who you're talking about.
Alex Honnold.
And that's one of the craziest things. I mean, what happens in your mind to make you look at this big thing and say, yeah, I can do that.
You know, I'm gonna go
hold my beer.
Yeah. I mean he's an amazing climber. I don't know that I'd want him to be my VC, so I think he might fly a little loose
his risk tolerance is a little too
high. His very different than ours. So but no, I think, you know, my wife's like, hey, don't get any ideas. That's, we're not doing that. So but professionally, I've over the years volunteered to help different organizations combat, human trafficking and online child predators and track them down. So I'm actually 2 months out from launching my own nonprofit, which is what I've been focused on lately, which has that mission of tracking down online predators, assisting law enforcement with investigations, and then educating the public on the threats that are out there. So
that's awesome. What can you say what the name of it is, or you yep. want to wait?
It's Operation Torchlight. And we're putting things in place right now to get that website up and start our mission, because we have some very dedicated security pros that are on the team, on the board, along with some law enforcement folks. And it's a huge issue that, you know, I think there are a lot of cybersecurity pros out there that want to help with the mission, but there's just not a lot of organizations out there right now. So I wanted to throw my name in the hat and hopefully help and make an impact wherever I can on this epidemic that's going on. So
that's wonderful. I love to hear that. I think in our industry, I don't think it's obviously not limited to our industry, but there are so many great stories about folks that as they've progressed in their career, that they're giving back. And that's really, you realize that as you progress, that's really, it doesn't matter about titles or salary or the size of your house. I mean, it's all great. You need that stuff in order to live and all that. But at the end of the day, it's making a difference. I'm so happy to hear about Operation Torchlight and look forward to learning more about that as it comes. I'm looking forward to the announcement of it launching.
Yes. Yeah, we're excited.
Well, Chris, appreciate it. It has been one of the more entertaining conversations I've had. I'll have to, maybe next time if I intravenously take Celsius, I'll even be more animated in some way, shape, or form. But it was great having you on. I appreciate you taking the time to spend just a few minutes with us this morning and chat. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Greg.
And everybody, stay secure.